Hello and welcome to another episode of the Black Business Psychology Network's podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Grace Mansour-Rusu, and just wanted to apologise, not been around for a while. Everybody needs a period of rest and recuperation and, you know, to regroup. So we have another episode for you today featuring a really interesting, really inspirational, really accomplished guest. So the next voice you'll hear after mine will be mine, but will be with Dr. Sula Windgassen. So Dr. Sula Windgassen is a chartered health psychologist, as well as she also has a PhD in medical sciences from King's College London, which is a University of London college. She also is an EMDR therapist, a cognitive behavioural therapist, and a researcher. EMDR is a form of therapy used to reprogram traumatic memories to neutralize them. So EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. That's what it means. So Dr. Sula Windgassen is trained in this technique, and it's quite effective for treating forms of trauma. Dr. Sula's area of expertise when it comes to research is chronic illnesses, pain, fatigue, irritable bowel syndrome, urinary tract infections, for example, and also things like urinary urgency. And that's who primarily she sees as clients for her therapeutic work and what she uses cognitive behavioural or CBT therapy on. Dr. Sula's journey into the area of health psychology, again, is very interesting. She actually started her academic career in her undergrad thinking she wanted to pursue law, and then changed to psychology soon after. So if you're interested in hearing about her career story, please stay tuned. Hi everyone, I know it's been a long time, but thank you for tuning in to this episode of the podcast. And I have every session is a special guest, so I'm going to let her introduce herself.
Hi, yeah, I'm Sula. I'm a health psychologist, CBT therapist, and EMDR therapist.
I actually was writing down all of the things and I didn't put EMDR therapist on there.
That's maybe the most exciting one.
That's definitely a question, because I need to understand EMDR. Yeah. I don't understand it properly. It's brilliant. Lovely to have you. And you've got so many, like, people say this about me, you've got so many letters after your name, what do they all mean? But literally, like, we'll talk about that in a moment. So how would you summarize what you do, if that's possible?
How would I summarize? So I guess broadly speaking, my focus of work is on supporting people who have ongoing persistent physical symptoms or physical chronic conditions, manage those chronic conditions, in some cases reduce the impact and symptom severity, and in some case, you know, support adjustment to what's going to be a long-term prognosis. And I also work with a lot of people who've experienced trauma, and there it does seem to be a big overlap between, you know, the experience of trauma and the experience of physical symptoms, with a lot of fascinating research behind that. So clinically, I use a range of therapeutic modalities to do that clinical work. And then my research is also in that area, and it's more looking at, I suppose, patient experiences, so we get a better understanding of that and what the patient needs are and how we can meet that, rather than it being led by academic circles and biomedical kind of ideas, which often leave out the perspective of the patient to the detriment of the treatment efficacy. And I also focus on research that looks into the mechanisms, because again, that's really important for the use of psychological interventions for people with chronic health conditions that can easily seem dismissive or, you know, pathologizing of a physical health condition as, you know, just anxiety, all in your head, the, you know, the hysterical woman stereotype. Whereas research that looks into the mechanisms, you know, how does your psychological experience feed into your physical experience? My position on that is that that can be used to empower patients rather than disempower them, and it should be used in that way rather than, you know, to try and create a narrative that stigmatizes. So those are my areas of research and clinical practice.
Sounds so interesting. And I do think that link between body and mind, psychology and physiology, I take it for granted because I'm like, oh, obviously everybody knows that psychological health informs physical health, duh. But actually, it's so powerful, yet even medical professionals don't really sometimes see the link. And you're like, hang on, just read something. Like, there's how many papers on this? Surely you can figure it out.
It's hard because if you think of like a continuum where on one extreme, there's this narrative that it's all psychological, you know, all your physical symptoms are because of trauma or because you're so anxious, because you're not managing your stress. Obviously, that's inaccurate and really unhelpful. On the other end, you know, psychology plays no role in physical health. And so, you know, you just have to rely on these medications or surgery or nothing. And that's really unhelpful. Whereas, you know, what I'm trying to navigate and increase awareness of is this middle ground, which is a more biopsychosocial perspective, which is we have to pay attention to all of those things and look at how we integrate them. But it's so hard, especially on things like social media, where messaging can be so black and white, and you know, one sentence taken out of context can paint, you know, a huge inaccurate picture. So it's a real struggle, and particularly when patients are always experiencing dismissal. So my messaging can easily be conflated with the same thing. You know, it's all in your head, it's all psychological, when that's far from the mission.
I definitely understand that. We've got to be careful as professionals to be able to kind of position things and give people the empowerment, but obviously the knowledge, but without kind of shutting down certain areas that are very real for the individuals. Brilliant. Thank you so much. So I'm going to ask where it all started. So little Sheila hanging around like in primary school. How did you get here with all of your various degrees and research interests?
You've just given me a little flashback to little Sheila. Oh. Little shy Sheila on her own in the playground. How did it get here? So I suppose, well, this probably has a very implicit but significant role. My dad's a psychiatrist and my mum was a mental health nurse, and then she went into working in public health. Right. So there's always been, I suppose, conversations around the dinner table. Not that I had, you know, they split up when I was young, but that general atmosphere and environment of those, you know, that area of interest. And I was intrigued about, you know, hearing stories from work from both my parents, but consciously I don't think that played a big role. I suppose I was just always fascinated. I'm an only child as well, so I was always fascinated in trying to understand people, you know, people's behaviors, how they were thinking. I suppose maybe there was a bit more self-focus on me because I was an only child trying to fit in and navigate, you know, lots of different areas that I felt excluded from. So I suppose there was just a personal interest that was more implied rather than, you know, academic. And then but I wanted to be an actress, really. Which is funny because I was so shy. And then when I was a teenager, I got this huge, probably big drop of hormones or something. And then I felt a lot more confident. But anyway, it transpires that the college that I went to didn't do drama. So I just made do with film studies, did psychology, law, film studies and English. And then I was weighing up where to go in uni, whether I was going to do law or whether I was going to do psychology. And to cut a very long and personal story short, I got some bad advice, I think, which was to do law because psychology is so competitive. So I did law for a year at Leeds University and I just hated it. I thought, I'm going to be a freedom fighter. I'm going to, you know, stand up for the injustices that are done in the criminal law system. And then the more that I was there, I mean, I think it only took about 3 weeks for me to clock on that everybody was doing law to try and make lots of money. And that criminal law is the worst paying part of the profession and very stressful. And so I just thought, you know what, there's better ways that I can help people that are probably going to be more rewarding, not make lots of money, because psychology generally doesn't. But I'm okay with that because I find law incredibly dull and I find psychology incredibly interesting. So I decided to change to psychology, but just at the same university. And I was really lucky because serendipitously my best friend, who I hadn't met yet, did the same thing. She was doing a different degree. And then we were introduced by my roommate in first year, and then we just hit it off and had had a really lovely time. Both really interested in health psychology. Had a great lecturer, health psychology lecturer called Daryl O'Connor. I was going to call him Rory. He's got a twin brother called Rory, who actually later on ended up being my PhD thesis examiner.
That's good.
Familiar face, because they're identical twins. So did psychology, really enjoyed it. But again, you know, there's that whole problem in psychology where everybody tells you how competitive it is and you have to get all this work experience. And I got into doing some marketing work on the side. And then I got roped into becoming a full-time marketing manager there prematurely, I think, for this small business. And initially it was exciting, but then the reality dawned, which was all of my friends left the university city. And there was just a small group of us left, but in disparate areas. So some people were working in bars, so I would never see them. Some people, you know, still at uni doing different things. And then me working in this environment that felt very removed from my university life. And I wasn't finding it very interesting or rewarding anymore. And then I'd started to get urinary tract infections, which I'd had as a teenager recurrently, but they'd always passed with antibiotics. But this time they just weren't. So I had investigation after investigation, and then the symptoms were evolving and they were changing, and I was getting more worried that they wouldn't go, and I was feeling less like myself. I was in a new relationship and it was obviously affecting our sex life. I was feeling very lonely. I was feeling lonely probably before, but even more so when I was really symptomatic. And then I just got incredibly depressed, really, because of the symptoms. And then I started getting chronic migraines, which were happening every other day. And it just meant that I couldn't work, and they only had statutory sick pay. So, you know, finances were worrying.
Yeah.
So then I took a break where I went to go stay with my dad, and he was doing a master's in mindfulness. And he said,
I love academics. It's just like, I know. Just I'm a psychiatrist. I'm just going to do another degree. Why not?
And he, thank God he was, because he suggested it to me, which initially felt very invalidating and like missing the spot. But when his partner explained to me why it might be helpful in a really tactful way, which was, you know, essentially these symptoms are really difficult, they're causing you a lot of distress, and they're putting your body in, you know, a stress mode. Essentially your central nervous system's firing off all sorts of scary messages, and it's, you know, centralizing out, you're getting migraines now, and all of this kind of stuff. I was getting stomach problems as well, I think. And so we can try and take off some of those layers by changing the way you're relating to your experience, because obviously you just resist against getting these horrible symptoms. You kind of don't want them. You search your brain for how you might get rid of them. You withdraw, you know, all of these things, which make intuitive sense. And sometimes you've got no other option, but over a long period of time, they really are counterproductive to your physical and mental health. So I started practicing mindfulness, and I found that that really did change not the symptoms necessarily, but the way I felt about them, the way I was relating to them. And then I got, I decided to go back to Leeds to try and work again, had an appointment with a psychotherapist, which I thought was, you know, mindfulness trained person that would have experience in physical health. But I think what he was more like was a really psychodynamic person that missed the point entirely, and really, really, it wasn't a pleasant therapeutic experience. So I can really relate to women that speak to me now about, you know, people trying to root around for a black box of trauma that's caused their symptoms. And, you know, it can be really, really damaging. And yeah, that repelled me for a right while, where in actual fact, what I was looking for was a health psychologist to
right. just get
me through all of this. But I didn't know it was a thing, even though I'd done a health psychology module, it was still, right. you know, a barely acknowledged profession.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We must have done, they weren't called health psychology modules. They were called other things. But when I think about it now, like, that must have been a health psychology module. But yeah, I don't think I even knew about health psychology really as a route from you know, mainstream mm-hmm. psychology. So I think now it's a lot better. But back in the day when I was mm-hmm. studying undergraduate, it really wasn't. So absolutely, like, what it means and how that profession can actually help people, I think, needs to be communicated better to students studying psychology, but generally the public anyway.
Absolutely. But like we were kind of speaking about before we got started, there's so much variation within the profession, so it can look very different. You know, so many health psychologists aren't actually clinically trained, so they wouldn't be able to help in that situation either. So yeah, there's some systemic issues. But to go back to how I got here, so I was really fascinated by how my experience had changed from changing my approach to my symptoms. Not that that was easy, but I had support. I was lucky. I had support from my dad. You know, I had the resources to go and do mindfulness training. So I was getting support from others to guide me through this process. And then I decided to go and do a master's in health psychology to learn more about, you know, why this helped, how it might help further. And the rest is history. I kind of went to King's to study this master's and never left until 2018 or 19, after finishing the master's, the PhD, the postdoc, and the diploma in CBT. Yeah, I really stayed there a while.
Might as well just stay, get all the way. So that's interesting. So you went to do the health psychology master's, completed that. Was there a funded PhD place there for you after that? Or
my route was quite unusual. So the research group there, so my master supervisor, who was also the head of the department, luckily enough, had been involved in getting NIHR grant funding for a big randomized controlled trial assessing cognitive therapy in IBS. And so there was spaces for either one research assistant or two part-time research assistants. And she was pushing for two part-time research assistants so that those research assistants could also do a part-time PhD based on the trial.
Oh, brilliant.
Which meant that the PhD wasn't funded, but because we would be employed as research assistants at King's, the tuition fee would be part-time and it would be highly subsidized. So I think it was like 600 quid a year, so it was completely
sounds like a dream. That's brilliant. I love your supervisor actually had really good foresight, because I think that's a really good way of doing it. You get the practice, you're actually getting the research stuff from the paid job, but then you're getting something out of it other than just experience. Absolutely. That's brilliant. So how did you find that experience of?
I felt so lucky. Yeah. I felt so lucky to have it that way, because I was in the department with some amazing people who had funded PhDs and did amazing stuff themselves. But sometimes it was all on them. They were the recruiter, they were the analyzer, they were the everything, you know, the entire project manager. And they had themselves to consult and their supervisors, but their supervisors were busy. So you get, I don't know, supervision once a month sometimes. But whereas I had another half, you know, I had the other research assistant who was also doing her PhD. So we could chat. We had similar issues that we had to tackle both in the job and in our PhDs. So we just had this moral support from an experience that was so shared, which was amazing. And it just felt the opposite of isolating. It felt incredibly supportive, plus the wider trial team. So we got to recruit many more participants in the context of a randomized control trial, but we also got to learn about these processes of research that we never would have been able to understand, you know, just doing it the usual way, where you have like much smaller studies that are feasible for one person and one person only. So yeah, brilliant. It was really great.
Hit the jackpot there, I think. That sounds really cool. And then after that, is that when you proceed the postdoc in the same subject?
Yeah, so whilst I was doing that PhD, that's when I kind of staggered also doing the doctoral qualification in health psychology.
I was going to ask, like, did you do them?
Sandwich them all together.
Yeah.
And so, because in the first year of the PhD, it was a lot more kind of speculative. We were putting processes in place, but recruitment wasn't kicking off yet. We were pulling in resources to develop materials, but there was a lot more flexible stuff. So it meant that I could go off and do training and things to equip me to then develop my own intervention and then to carry it out. So it sandwiched together all quite well. And I finished the doctoral qualification in health psychology in 3 years, and I finished the PhD in 4 years. So that's kind of how that process went.
So it was all at the same time, so it kind of overlapped.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because you fulfilled like the chartership process by doing the I know people that are doing that, did occupational psychology research PhDs, and at the same time got the professional chartership at the same time, because you just overlap it. So that sounds like it was a really good way of doing it, because you end up killing two birds with one stone, for one of a better
analogy.
It
can be intense, but it was okay. Absolutely. It's okay for my early 20s.
You got the energy then.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I think that's a really great, I was going to ask you, are you a chartered health site? So you got the chartership, but then you're also, you basically in a way got a double doctorate.
Yeah,
you've got the professional doctorate and the research doctorate. So tick, tick, tick. Brilliant. And then the CBT. So how did the therapy, I mean, it sounds like it's very organic for you, but when did you decide that you wanted to do CBT training as well?
So I think I'd always known since starting back on the health psychology route that I wanted to work therapeutically with people.
Right.
What I was trying to calculate when I got back into, you know, studying health psychology was what's the best way to go around it, because outside of clinical psychology, the training in becoming a psychotherapist, of being able to deliver therapy, isn't as clear cut, and of course it can be really costly. So what I'd noticed was there was a Health Education England funded CBT diploma at King's, but it wasn't really clear when I was doing the master's, like how you could get on it. It wasn't something that you could pay to get on. You had to apply and you needed to already have a particular qualification as a health psychologist or as a psychologist or as a psychiatrist, or, you know, a core profession essentially. Mm-hmm. And that model changed throughout, and so then it started to allow psychological well-being practitioners to apply for it as well. But at the time I was thinking, if I could only get there, then I could get this training. I don't know how thorough I was in my planning. I know I definitely thought that when I was doing my master's, but it wasn't like this was the plan and the thread that I had all along. Yeah. But then it just turned out that it did work out that way. So after my PhD, I got a part-time postdoc.
Right.
And that was developing a CBT-based intervention for fatigue, pain, and urgency in inflammatory bowel disease. And that was after and being involved in developing the CBT intervention for irritable bowel syndrome. So I was really interested in the use of CBT. I'd come in via mindfulness, but the two go together really cohesively. So it got me looking again about how I might get trained in that. And I applied to Oxford University Cognitive Therapy Centre to do a certificate, which could then turn into a diploma. But again, that came with cost. And it also meant quite a lot of time taken out because I would have to do it alongside my postdoc. And so it was going to be quite full on. So I also applied then for the CBT diploma at King's at the University of Surrey. I think that was it. Maybe I applied somewhere else. And no, I think that was it. And I ended up getting a place on the course. So then I didn't go to Oxford. So that's always a nice thing that I have put it in my little successes folder, actually, this acceptance letter from Oxford University that I didn't take.
I turned them down. That sounds really, it all seems sort of like tied together. Like you had the plan, you didn't probably know at the beginning how it would all work out, and it's all worked out. I think it's really great. And I think that's about, I think a lot of people have like outcomes they'd like to achieve, and they might be a bit more rigid in how they think it's going to happen. But often with psychology anyway, it doesn't happen exactly how you think it will, but you'll eventually get there somehow, or you'll end up doing something slightly or totally different, but you're there for the right reasons. So I think that's a really interesting example of how you found yourself in the place that you wanted to be. It sounds like a really comfortable fit.
I think you're so right. It's nice and important to have the plan and look at the different options, but rigidity will only make it more anxiety provoking because there's no guarantees, and you're constantly given this message that, you know, you don't fit there, especially in health psychology. Oh, you don't quite fit there, you're not clinical, but you're not completely research, you know, you're not this, you're not that. Whereas if you can just do it a bit like an adventure and explore and see where you get, it probably will be okay.
I feel like that's exactly it. It's all about like, it is about the adventure of getting there. And obviously it's not fun times for everybody. It isn't, because sometimes, you know, you're trying to knock on a door and it doesn't open. Throughout this podcast, we've listened to people that, as one educational psychologist, he qualified a couple of years ago, but literally he applied for clinical like 4 times and then applied to EdSite like 3 times. And it took him like 10 years to get on EdSite. And I was just like, but the journey was horrible, but at least throughout the journey, he's learned so much, and it informs what he does now. So it is all about the journey, but I'm not going to dismiss like people's horrible experiences, and it shouldn't really be like you're applying 4 or 5 times to get onto a course that doesn't, it's not helping anyone there really. So absolutely brilliant examples there. And my next question is about, what do you enjoy most about what you do? So we've had a few hints of this, but it'd be nice to hear your experiences.
I mean, it might sound terribly cliche, but it is definitely being there to facilitate people making meaningful change that, you know, has a real meaningful difference in their own experience in their own lives. That, you know, is such a wonderful thing to be able to be there for, but also learning so much from each patient. I mean, the models of therapy that I have trained in are or should be really collaborative and patient led. So we've got models and structures of how we can guide and provide support, but really they should be the kind of scaffolding that allows the person, the client, to make the meaningful connections and kind of own their own changes. And, you know, quite often I might be doing all sorts of delicate therapeutic work that I'm like, and now this, you know, this is going to be revealed to them. Not really quite like that, but, you know, and then they'll just go in a completely different direction, but it's so much better than where I was trying to get them to. So, you know, seeing people make meaningful changes, being able to facilitate that, and learning from every single session really, and every single person that I work with, even when journeys are really difficult, and even when I don't help them in the way that I would like to, you know, you're always reflecting and using that to grow and inform future growth and knowledge.
Absolutely. Thanks for sharing that. And I forgot to ask before this question, in terms of your roles now, because I know you wear different hats. So what do you do at the moment? Like, what's your portfolio of careers?
So I work 3 days clinically with patients. And so I work with a range of presentations, IBS, IBD, chronic urinary tract infections, endometriosis, probably more health conditions there in the mix, and trauma. And I use a range of CBT, compassion focused therapy, and EMDR. And then I try and keep the beginning of my week clinical, so I'll do supervision, be supervised, and yeah, kind of do all that kind of clinical stuff on those days. And then on the other days, I'm doing research. And at the moment, what that looks like is we're collecting a lot of data from women with experiences of chronic UTI. So we're creating an analysis plan, completing qualitative interviews, and trying to develop next steps of patient-informed research questions and materials that we can use to advocate for patients and expand research in that area. And developing lots of resources for free for patients, because I have to say, having left the NHS, there is still part of me that holds that sense of responsibility to provide stuff for people that can't, you know, access private therapy. And that's part of why I'm doing the research as well, to see if there's a way that we can make things more accessible and it doesn't have to kind of bottleneck at high-priced one-on-one sessions. So a range of things.
Brilliant. And the research work, is that attached to a university?
So that's so my company is called Mind Body Blossom. So we go for grants in conjunction with university. So this one's with Teesside University. More with Teesside University and perhaps other universities, so that we then use the money that we get to spend on the research that we're doing.
Okay, so you're literally like a sole. You're not attached to any university at the moment. You're doing it all alone. So you're doing the private clinical work 3 days, and then you're like a self-employed research company on the other days, and then collaborate with universities. I get it. That sounds really interesting, like combination of portfolio career. I always talk about portfolio careers because, you know, I think, again, for a lot of psychologists, even, you know, a clinical psychologist that's employed by the NHS, for example, or an educational psychologist employed by Department for Education, they're more increasingly doing this, you know, private work on the side, or, you know, they're creating content for free on social media. So I think there's a lot of ways that people can tap into their interests. So it doesn't always have to be the 9 to 5. You can do other things outside of your main role, or you can ditch your main role and just do like three. You can do three at once.
Yeah, that's definitely been, I think that's been my whole career really. Just a bit of everything.
And again, in psychology, there's always this dichotomy between researcher versus practitioner, which does my head in. Like, it makes me really annoyed. But what are your thoughts about it? Because you're doing both. So, and again, I do think that's probably a little bit more synonymous with other areas in psychology, like clin psych, educational psych, and health psych, because those roles, you're mostly in a clinical, you're probably in a client-facing role at the same time, whereas other professions within psychology, it's a bit more clear-cut. How do you find that collaboration? Do you find it difficult? Do you find it easy? What's it like for you?
It's funny because I was just having a conversation with my assistant trainee health psych today about completing qualitative interviews, and we were saying it's it's difficult because you have to park your clinician hat where you're asking people questions, where you would usually, like, you know, respond with empathy, or you would summarize back in depth, and you would then ask them more about that, and you might offer up some thoughts and interpretations, and it would be quite therapeutic. Whereas with qualitative research, you don't want to lead them at all. So it's very it can feel very kind of curt when you're asking questions in that way. So sometimes I suppose there's a bit of a adjustment between roles, but generally speaking, I think they lend quite well to each other, because you're seeing research concepts in practice and vice versa, and I think the two really inform each other. And I was thinking about this in relation to one specific thing in my field of research, where there's a measure which is called the pain catastrophizing scale, which has a lot of
love scales. I love them, and they have the best. I'm literally writing that down.
The name, I think, is so terrible and stigmatizing, because that word catastrophizing, even when we use it with like cognitive processes, feels very judgmental. But generally, people with anxiety that I've spoken to about it, and I've used that term, they seem to be okay with it. But when you're identifying it in relation to pain, which is catastrophic, you know, depending on the severity, it can feel like it's very blaming, and it doesn't acknowledge the degree of pain. So that feels like a very academically research developed scale, right? But the validity of the measure is still super useful, because it identifies really important processes that people do engage in. When you felt pain, which is really threatening, you're kind of on guard to feeling it again, and you're worried about having it again. And when you get a slight twinge, then you think, oh gosh, this is going to go into a full flare-up. I guess that's what the pain catastrophizing measure is trying to measure, how much that happens in your head, which then primes all of your physiology to then, you know, experience pain. But going back to this terrible name, it just is so stigmatizing. So when we talk about it in conferences, if patients were to hear it, they would think that we're just kind of colluding to say this is on them, this is their fault, you know, they have they're just worrying about their pain too much. But it's much more nuanced than that. So I feel like being a bit of both, being a clinician, being a researcher, helps to just think about the translation between the two in a meaningful way that can be useful. And I'm learning all of the time. Like, I just did an Instagram post today disseminating some findings from my and my colleague's systematic review about psychological factors in endometriosis, and I got so much initially quite harsh comments back, but I completely understood it, because it felt like I was saying endometriosis has a psychological etiology, which I absolutely was not. But because people are so primed to hearing and having those experiences, that's the message that comes out. So it's so important how we communicate research. And I think being a clinician can help, you know, consider those things as well.
Absolutely. Like, what do I say to somebody who's come to see me? It's all well and good having this research, but how does that translate in real life so they understand and also are empowered rather than discouraged? Because, you know, yeah, sometimes medical professionals can end up making people feeling worse about the condition and a bit more stuck. So yeah, that's really, really important.
Yeah.
Also, you've spoken about your time in the NHS, and I wanted to ask, around when you were in the NHS, how did you find it to navigate with other psychologists? So possibly clinical psychotherapists, psychiatrists, etc. How did it work for you?
I worked in primary care mental health services. So I was generally with a load of CBT therapists, although there was a couple of counselling and clinical psychologists in my service. Generally, the only clinical psychologists I'd see apart from that were trainees, where we were providing supervision, or they were just amongst the service. But then as I was developing the long-term conditions pathway and forging relationships outside of our service with secondary care, physical health services, then I would meet with occupational therapists, physiotherapists, social workers, and clinical psychologists. And that was really lovely because there was a shared sense of, yes, we need to improve integration and people were up for it. But the thing that was the challenge for all of us was finding time to dedicate to doing things that would improve integration.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of good, willing participants across the professions, but we were all impacted by the same systemic issues.
Brilliant. So yeah, you tried to kind of forge a way of working that would actually put the clients and the patients at the core rather than just doing the dance around it. That's not my problem, you deal with that. Yeah. I don't know why you're asking me that, stop asking me that. I think that ultimately it's quite difficult to do within a service like the NHS because it is quite siloed. At the same time, I think it's quite empowering and you are getting more multidisciplinary working. So I think that's probably the way things are going. So that sounds really, really useful, not just for yourselves, but for the clients and the patients that you're working with.
Yeah, we had some really nice successes with this integrated, I forget what they call it now, but it was meant to be like an integrated health hub. Mm-hmm. And from the community, patients would be presented as, you know, needing extra input. And so they'd be presented to a team of community nurses, district nurses, social workers, OTs, the physiotherapy clinic, and myself as a representative of primary care mental health. And then we would all kind of think about what could be helpful. Would it be useful for me to give them a call? And we had such lovely successes from that. Not many, I must say, because it took an awful lot of work and resources, you know, across all of us. But when we did, you could see it made a real valuable difference to that patient's journey. There was much more cohesion and people were on the same page and the patient was kind of responded to differently. So
yeah,
it is the way forward. It's just finding an efficient way of doing it.
Absolutely. And my next question is around race and gender. And if they have impacted your educational / work experiences and possibly like not advice to the profession, but feedback to the profession as to how that could be made better. If
I guess, you know, I'm aware that I've got light skin privilege. So my mum's Asian and she's much darker skinned than me. My dad's white and he's Dutch. But, you know, I was talking a little bit about young Sula. I was darker when I was younger and grew up in kind of very white Liverpool. So I always felt different. And yeah, I think there's lots of different factors involved in that, but that was definitely part of it. But I guess as I grew up, it didn't really factor as much, but then coming into university, I mean, I'm getting a flashback to one of the things that really solidified me wanting to leave law, which was I was talking to a friend of a friend. They met each other through boarding school or something like that. And I was like, oh, wow, you went, I can't remember what you said. You're from Liverpool. Bloody good job getting into law at Leeds. And I was like, oh, my God, first of all, it's not Oxford. And two, what? I didn't even think of myself as like, you know, I don't know, from the lower echelon.
Well, the assumption there is that you're some kind of like doc hanging around like some, I don't know, there's an assumption of class and accessibility. Absolutely. And all sorts of things based on Liverpool.
Exactly.
Very loaded.
But that was law, and that again was one of the reasons that I hated law. It was so cliquey like that. So in psychology it felt much more at Leeds kind of my, there was less cliqueyness. In fact, I didn't experience any. But then what I have been aware of is being a woman and being a psychologist in the field of health psychology, you're kind of doubly disadvantaged because medics tend to think that they have, I'm sorry, that's a terrible generalization, but there is a culture within medicine that that's the most important, knowledgeable, science-backed thing, and psychology is just a bit airy-fairy. So there's automatically that kind of dynamic. And then when you're a woman also, you're much more likely to be ignored or undermined. And I've had terrible experiences with consultants when I was doing my health psychology master's on placement recruiting for a study that I was involved in, you know, having me shadow patients, but then having like flippant conversations with the patient about a film that they'd watched about, you know, sex therapy. But in that regard, they were talking about the therapist would have sex with the patient. So I don't know, you know, an interesting term. And then, you know, just in a really casual way in another patient consultation. So it wasn't even the same patient. The consultant saying to me, say, so if you do want to be a sex therapist, you're going to have to know about this lube, because they were talking about catheterization. And I was just like, this is so inappropriate, and you would not be treating a male like this at all. So yeah, I mean, there's been lots of experiences of being a woman where I've felt it's hard to try and advocate and assert yourself in a way that you're taken seriously and you're respected. It feels like you have to be a lot more strategic so that you're not seen as, I don't know, like the troublesome woman
or a walkover or too aggressive. It's the mental gymnastics that
exactly,
you know, you've got to do before you even get into the situation is exhausting. Yeah. It's just and thank you for sharing about, you know, both of those those examples, because it does seem like some of it is implicit and you might not realize at the time, but then also some of them are really explicit, more blatant examples of just assumption making and like stereotypes and microaggressions or micro incivilities. And I think that it does shape people's perception of what they could face in a career, or, you know, and being open about it is really important, and sharing is really important. So thanks.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I worked in Croydon when I was working in the NHS. And one of the things that I was really looking forward to coming out of academia and working in trials was the diversity of the population that I was going to be working with, because in the trials does tend to be, you know, white, more middle class. Whereas in Croydon, it's, you know, a lovely spread of everybody. And, you know, it feels like such a long time ago, but when there was such a huge spotlight on racial inequalities, unconscious bias, all of this exciting stuff was going on, you know, the black squares on social media, we had a really brilliant response to that within our service. And we had a lot of different ethnicities amongst our employees, workers, my colleagues. And you know, they were sharing stories about, even in a borough as diverse as ours, patients reacting differently to them because of their names, and choosing not to have an icon picture because it would change patients' perceptions of them. And, you know, reactions that they'd got because when they'd gone on to Zoom or something, when they'd been on the phone previously, and be like, oh, I didn't realize, you know. And it just opened my eyes, because these were things that people were just absorbing and wasn't really talked about, and suddenly the forum was there and it was talked about, and it was important and it was prioritized. And yeah, that was a really, really important thing for us all to do.
Absolutely. And I hope it stays, like,
yeah,
the last 2 years there's definitely been a flurry that hopefully there's like spaces where that this kind of diversity inclusion is not just, you know, an add-on, it's embedded within services and processes and things, so you're not having people feeling like they can't be their true selves or can't express themselves, especially in health settings, because obviously we know the outcomes very much show in health,
yeah,
based on the outcomes. It's very glaring when you see the figures. So hopefully there'll be more spaces and more awareness of how important it is. So thank you for sharing. So yeah, only two more quick questions. What are your future plans? The future of Dr. Seela's practice, Mind Body Blossom.
Oh God, I don't know.
Okay, no worries. It's not a test. It's okay. No pressure.
I am really hoping to develop the practice so that there can become more accessibility, because at the moment it's just me and the patients that I can see one-to-one, and then we've got some groups which are a bit more affordable but still expensive for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to develop a model where we can have either a not-for-profit arm where, you know, things can be massively subsidized, or just more affordable options where people can get ongoing support and it's not cut off. There's a sense of community. This is what I'm kind of floating around ideas in my mind at the moment. And I suppose that's partly where I've been so blocked today, is just thinking about that longer term ambition. And it could be so big and it can be hard to think, you know, where are you getting started with? But I would also like that to include integration with other professions. So it's not, you know, it doesn't end up being, it's all psychological and trauma. It's, you know, integrated. When a pelvic health physio would be helpful, we can get in touch with the one. When, you know, it'd be useful for a doctor to review medications, we can get in touch with one. So that's the big idea of what I want to develop. Yeah, but short term, I'll just trottle on.
That sounds really cool, that multidisciplinary platform, so people can access kind of like a one-stop shop. But yeah, so you're not just being thrown from pillar to post, and it's a little bit more accessible for people. That sounds really good. So all the best with that, and I'm sure a few people will be, maybe some more people will be in touch after this to you. I will put all your information in the description so people can access your brilliant social media posts as well as your website. I am a fan of your Instagram. It's really, really informative. So, and I know a lot of work goes into those posts. So yeah. Last but not least, what advice would you give to any aspiring psychologists out there who want to follow a similar pathway or who are interested in health psychology?
I would say, don't be put off by the notion that everything's competitive. Because as competitive as the profession can be, there's no rush. It can be nice to think about, I want to be at this stage and this bit will look really good, but I can tell you, having got to the stage that I've aspired to for a long time, your brain just moves on to the next thing that you think it would be really good to get to. And all of those little things on the way really do pave what happens when you get to the place that you're setting out to get to. So really try and absorb them, get the most from them, not be in a rush to get past them. And embrace them, and you use a bit of intuition with a bit of, you know, pragmatism, and be flexible with yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree, flexibility is the key. I mean, last two years hasn't taught us anything. Should have taught us that, I'll tell you that. I didn't think I'd still be at home working from home most of the time 3 years ago. Absolutely not. But yeah, that's it. But thank you so much for really, really interesting, and I knew it would be.